From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our look at the coming battle over judicial nominees to the federal appellate and Supreme Courts. We talk with Boyden Gray, founder of the conservative group The Committee for Justice. Its mission is to promote and support the president's judicial nominees. Gray was also part of the Bush transition team in 2000 and was counsel to the first President Bush. Yesterday, we heard from Ralph Neese of the liberal group People for the American Way. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Happiness in Magazines, the new solo album by Graham Coxon, who is the lead guitarist for the British band Blur. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Monday, President Bush renominated 12 candidates for federal appeals courts. Democratic senators opposed these nominees during Bush's last term because they considered them to be on the far right and outside the judicial mainstream. Seven of the nominees were blocked by Democratic filibusters. In reaction, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has been talking about ending the use of the filibuster. Yesterday, we heard from Ralph Neese, president of the liberal group People for the American Way. My guest today is Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice. Its mission is to defend and promote the president's judicial nominees. Gray serves on the board of the Federalist Society, an organization of conservative and libertarian lawyers. Gray served as counsel to George H.W. Bush during his years as vice president and president. He worked on the White House transition team of George W. Bush in 2000. Gray is also a partner at the Washington law firm of Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, where he focuses on regulatory matters. What's at stake, as far as you're concerned, in the judicial appointment process now? And we're talking about federal judicial appointments, and there's also likely to be at least one Supreme Court justice who will need to be replaced during Bush's second term.
Well, ultimately, what's at stake is the independence of the federal judiciary, which is a key component of our governing structure and the separation of powers. What the Democrats want to do is shape the bench to fit certain preconceived ideological goals. Now, I'm quite willing to recognize that they would say, well, that's exactly what the president's doing or trying to do, and but there are a couple of points here. Now, what the president's trying to do is to nominate individuals who will not legislate from the bench, who will not impose their own personal views on the electorate through the courts, people who will interpret the Constitution as it was written, interpret legislation as it was written, and not make things up. Furthermore, if the electorate doesn't like this approach, which has been fairly consistent for Republican presidents going back at least to President Reagan. This has been the approach taken by Presidents Reagan, Bush, and Bush 1 and Bush 2. If the public doesn't like that, they can, under the Constitution, elect a different president. But as it is, under the Constitution we have, the president has the not just the right but the duty to nominate individuals he thinks are best fit for the federal judiciary, and what the Democrats are trying to do is to deny the president that right and shape these courts of appeals in ways that they want to do it. And this, I think, is something that the Constitution does not assign to a senator from New York. It's a duty the Constitution assigns to the president.
But isn't it the job of senators to give their advice and consent on judiciary matters such as this, and isn't it the job of the Senate to serve as a check and balance? The president's judicial nominees have to be approved by the Senate, and if the Senate disagrees, if senators disagree, then isn't that part of the checks and balances system? I mean, don't the Democrats have a right to forcefully dissent from the president's choices?
Of course.
Just as the president has a right to forcefully nominate his choices.
Well, but you said it very well. The Senate has a right and a duty to reject if they see fit to do so. They're not doing that. They're, in most cases now, denying the president and the nominees an up or down vote. If the Democrats were simply saying, we're going to amass 51 votes to defeat a nominee, which I don't think they can do, but if they were to do that, we'd be sitting here, I'd be sitting here saying, well, that's their constitutional prerogative, but they're not doing that. They're insisting that no vote take place at all, and I don't think that's what the Constitution envisioned. It's clearly not what the Constitution envisioned, and the fight is all over this issue, whether the Democrats can block nominees from having an up or down vote.
You're referring to the filibuster, to the Democrats'
that's
use of
correct.
The filibuster.
Well, it's really simply raising the vote count from 50 to 60. That's what the Democrats have done. They've just sort of unilaterally said, all right, you need 60 votes now, not 50. We've lost the majority. We don't have more than 50 senators anymore. But we do have more than 40, so we're going to ask you to come up with 60 votes rather than 50, and that's just too bad. If you think the Constitution contemplates a majority vote, you are wrong. We're changing it, we're rewriting it, and we're going to ask you to come up with 60.
But the filibuster has always been a part of the Senate, so in what sense is that rewriting? And I know a lot of Democrats would probably say, in a time like this, when Republicans control the House, the Senate, there's a Republican president, that it's all the more important to have access to a technique like a filibuster for the Democrats to make their voice heard and to be a part, an active part of the bipartisan process, as opposed to having Republicans just pass everything that they want.
Well,
to
that's what the electorate
majority.
Yeah, sure, but that's what the public. I mean, it's like saying, "Well, gee whiz, we live in a democracy, but if the public is stupid enough, mean enough, nasty enough to elect Republicans to each put Republicans in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, why then we have to change the Constitution to somehow restore our power." I mean, that's nutty. Absolutely nutty. And, I mean, it's...
But this is what confuses
again,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean
ahead.
To interrupt you. What confuses me is it sounds like it's Republicans who are trying to change the rules on this one because...
No. It's the Democrats.
Have always...
What Senator Frist said is saying is, I want to restore the precedent, the historical precedent up until just a year ago, is to say nominees get up or down votes. That's never happened before. And if you can say all you want that filibusters have been a part of judicial nomination, a part of the judicial nomination process, but it's just not correct. It's just plain, flat wrong.
It might be semantics, but I know a lot of people would disagree with what you're saying and would say that the filibuster has been used in the past.
No judge has ever been defeated by a filibuster. That's all. I mean, uncontrovertible fact.
Are we talking about whether they've been defeated or whether the filibuster
has been attempted as a tactic? Well, I mean, it is said that Fortas was filibustered, but he was on the floor a week. If that's a filibuster, I'll grant you, you can keep someone hanging on the floor for a week, for five legislative days. That's not a filibuster. No judge has ever been. You cannot contradict my statement because there are no data for it.
My understanding is that although Senator Frist is now considering trying to end the filibuster, that he was one of 14 senators to vote in favor of a filibuster against a Clinton nominee named Richard Páez for the U.S. Court of Appeals.
Páez got confirmed. I don't know what you're talking about. No judge has ever been defeated by a filibuster.
I didn't say he was defeated. I said that Frist was
You can filibuster people and not defeat them. I don't understand. That's irrelevant. These judges are being blocked, being defeated by a filibuster. They're not getting up or down votes. And the Speaker, a minority leader of the Senate, issues a statement yesterday saying, how dare the President come back with these extremist judges after we've defeated them. Well, he hasn't defeated them. He's kept them from a vote. That has never happened before.
No, but what the Democrats are saying is that the Republicans kept many of the Clinton appointees from...
They did not do that. They never kept Clinton appointees from a vote. I don't know what you're talking about. There were more judges left dangling and more vacancies left unfilled because of tactics in the committee before a nominee got to the floor. More vacancies and more judges left dangling at the end of the first Bush administration than at the end of Clinton.
It is my understanding that during the Clinton years that Republicans blocked dozens of President Clinton's judicial appointments with procedural tactics.
Procedural tactics that have been used for 3 decades. But I'm trying to tell you that some judges did not make it through committee, but there were more such blockages in the first Bush administration than there were in Clinton. But none of this was done by filibuster, either Bush 1 or Clinton.
Let me try to paraphrase something that Ralph Neese of People for the American Way said on our show yesterday and get your response to that. He said, there is a Republican president, but he won by 3%, 51% to 48%. And right now, Republicans control the executive branch, the House, the Senate. And should there be should it be possible for a simple majority to be able to do whatever it wants without, for instance, a tool like the filibuster? Because the filibuster could force the Senate to compromise and to come up with a more moderate solution,
that's great
a more
if you're
bipartisan
a Democrat.
Solution.
Well, that's great if you're a Democrat. I mean, of course, if you're a Democrat or if you're a liberal, you think that, gee whiz, if you've lost at the ballot box, then let's change the rules inside the Senate. And I don't blame them for trying. I just hope they lose. I think they should lose. I'm sorry. They lost. And the danger on the Republican side is that with this newfound majority, which is so unique, really, for the last 100 years, the Republicans will blow it. They'll spend too much money in the Congress. They'll do this, they'll do that, and then they'll blow this opportunity that they've only now gotten for the first time in 100 years. That's my worry, but that's not my responsibility. My responsibility is over judges, a much narrower set of difficulties. And there, the president has the right to an up or down vote on his nominees. It's as simple as that. That's what the Constitution provides. And he's not going to be able to do that much that if the public doesn't like it, they can't change it 4 years from now.
So I think it's fair to say that what's happening now is that Democrats are saying Republicans are trying to change the rules by possibly outlawing withdrawing the use of the filibuster.
Well, I'm obviously not going to get you.
And Republicans are saying, no, it's the Democrats are trying to change the rules by using the filibuster for judicial nominees in the first place. Let me ask you another
question. I'm telling
question.
You, it's yes, that's the way. But let me just say, no judge has ever been killed by a filibuster before. That's never happened until last year. So, all right, who's changing the rules? I'll, let your readers decide that. Listeners, I'm sorry.
My guest is Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice, which supports and promotes President Bush's judicial nominees. Yesterday, we talked about judicial nominees with Ralph Neese, president of the liberal group People for the American Way. Boyden Gray will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Boyden Gray, and he's the founder of the Committee for Justice, which is a group that supports President Bush's judicial nominees and will work on their behalf during the confirmation process. Now, you've said that all of the president's nominees are solidly within the mainstream of American legal opinion, and Democrats have said that some of those nominees are not, including some of the nominees that President Bush is renominating. So let's talk about a couple of those nominees. One of them is William Pryor. Tell me your thoughts about William Pryor.
He's perfectly a straightforward nominee. Senator Spector has said he wants to have another hearing on Pryor so he can demonstrate to his colleagues that the opinions that Pryor has written as a judge, because he was not a judge before, he was the state attorney general, while he was appointed as a recess appointment, are perfectly mainstream. To prove that he's perfectly mainstream, he is perfectly mainstream. And there's simply no way one can say with a straight face that the nominees of President Bush, current President Bush, are somehow out of the mainstream. It's just not the case. And there's nothing out of the mainstream about William Pryor, absolutely nothing.
Let me read an excerpt of a letter from the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights to Orrin Hatch, who was the head of the Judiciary Committee at the time that this was written in June of 2003 when he was first nominated. Pryor is one of the architects of the so-called states' rights movement that seeks to limit the power of Congress to enact legislation that protects our civil and constitutional rights. Further along in the letter, it says, Pryor has also been a vocal opponent on the rights of criminal defendants. In one case, he vigorously defended Alabama's practice of handcuffing prison inmates to outdoor hitching posts if they refused to work on chain gangs or otherwise disrupted them, arguing that this practice did not violate the prisoner's right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. And that was overturned by the Supreme Court. And then in another case, it says, Pryor has also taken a number of actions hostile to the rights of gays and lesbians. He filed an anti-gay amicus brief in Lawrence versus Texas, urging the Supreme Court to uphold Texas's law banning same-sex sodomy. Pryor argued that, quote, a constitutional right that protects the choice of one's partner and whether and how to connect sexually must logically extend to activities like prostitution, adultery, necrophilia, bestiality, possession of child pornography, and even incest and pedophilia. What do you think of those comments from the head of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights?
Well, I mean, to say that Pryor is a chief architect of approach taken by this current Supreme Court over the last two decades to accord more sovereignty to the states, to say he's an architect of something that's become the law of the land, is to me not a criticism of him being out of the mainstream. How can you criticize someone as being out of the mainstream by accusing him of being one of the contributors to the very mainstream that he's supposed to be not a part of? I don't understand that. You can pick an individual case. I'm not familiar with either of those briefs, but the arguments in Lawrence v. Kansas were made by lots of people who I think would be, by the American public, considered quite in the mainstream. So I'm totally unpersuaded by an accusation that he contributed to a Supreme Court set of doctrines that have become the law of the land.
Many of the president's nominees are members of the Federalist Society, and this is a group that has a lot of well-known people who are members. You've been on the board of directors. The current and former heads of the Justice Department, John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez, are members. Former Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, former head of the Department of Interior Gail Norton, Senator Orrin Hatch, who is the former head of the Judiciary Committee, former Solicitor General Ted Olson, former independent counsel Kenneth Starr, former head of the Christian Coalition, President Donald Hodel. How would you describe the Federalist Society?
It's a debating society, probably best described. What they do is put on conferences that are very evenly balanced debates on legal, cutting-edge legal issues. I've never been to one of these panel discussions that wasn't totally and relentlessly and consistently evenly balanced between conservatives, if you will, and liberals, if you want to use labels to describe two sides of an issue. The two sides are always equally represented. They are great fun to attend, and they add a great deal to the intellectual debate in legal circles in America.
Ralph Neis, who was our guest on yesterday's show, he said of People for the American Way, said that although he knows you will describe the Federalist Society as a debating society, he would describe it as a partisan right-wing association of lawyers with an extremist judicial philosophy. So why don't I give you a chance to respond to that?
Well, what does he mean by extremist?
I
grant that the lawyers do who are members of the Federalist Society tend to share a point of view which is different than Ralph Neis's. That much I will concede, I mean, argue or even assert, but to say that Federalist Society is extremist would mean that Ralph Neis is extremist. I mean, I'll accept, I suppose, theoretically, hypothetically, for the sake of argument, I could accept a description of Federalist Society as extremist only if Ralph Neis would agree that he is extremist. And then we have a balance, and then it becomes irrelevant, because it is sort of irrelevant, isn't it?
In answer to your question, what he said about the Federalist Society is that it wants to basically turn back the Constitution or federal law to the pre-New Deal era, in which the Constitution, you know, before the Constitution was interpreted as justifying things like federal civil rights law, federal environmental law, Social Security. Protection Act for things like that. Yeah.
I am a member of the Federalist Society, and I have filed briefs and won cases arguing for equal protection for minorities. I have I've been the architect, was the architect of one of the, well, the most sweeping environmental statute in history, the Clean Air Act Amendments of 1990. I don't think anyone would accuse me of being, if they know me and know what I've done, accuse me, for example, of being anti-environmental. I mean, I just think that those are bogus descriptions. What the Federalist Society does stand for, if it stands for sort of anything, is a concept of limited government, of judges that interpret the Constitution and don't rewrite it and don't make it up. That's a shorthand way of describing what they're for. Nan Arryn, who is one of Ralph Neese's colleagues on the left, if you will, she's chairman of the Alliance for Justice, once said at a Federalist Society debate that the Federalist Society sponsored between her and me, she said, because the Republicans now control the House, the Senate, and the White House for the first time in basically 100 years, there is obviously no way we're going to get any new rights created by the Congress. So now we have to look to the courts to create new rights that we won't be able to get from the legislature. Now that's her talking. Those are her words, almost verbatim. And our view is those kinds of new rights ought to come from the people through the legislature, not from unelected judges.
Boyden Gray is the founder of the Committee for Justice, which supports and promotes President Bush's judicial nominees. Yesterday, we talked about judicial nominees with Ralph Neese, president of the liberal group People for the American Way. Boyden Gray will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice. It promotes and supports the president's judicial nominees. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by British singer-songwriter and guitarist Graham Coxon. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Boyden Gray. We've been talking about the coming battle over judicial nominees. On Monday, President Bush renominated 12 candidates for federal appeals courts. During his first term, their nominations had been blocked or slowed by Democrats who considered the candidates to be on the far right, outside of the judicial mainstream. Gray is the founder of the Committee for Justice, which supports and promotes the president's judicial nominees. He's on the board of the Federalist Society, a group of conservative and libertarian lawyers. The Federalist Society, correct me if I'm wrong here, many of the members believe in what's been called constitutionalism, original intent, or the Constitution in exile. And again, correct me if I'm misstating anything, but if that is an accurate statement, would you explain what those terms mean?
Well, they mean that the Constitution means what it says. That's what they mean. And I don't know how else to say it. I've been involved in a debate over wine importation into internet sales of wine. Can you order up a bottle of very fine wine from California and have it delivered to your house? And the 21st Amendment, which repealed the prohibition, says that the states can do just about anything they want to do about controlling the importation of alcohol into their borders. And there are good friends of mine who are conservatives, Clint Bolick among them, who believe we should ignore the 21st Amendment. But a constitutionalist would say, you can't ignore the 21st Amendment. It's there. It may be inconvenient. It may seem outmoded. But if you don't like it, repeal it. Don't just ignore it. Don't just act as though it didn't exist.
Is it accurate to say that a lot of the people in the Federalist Society would like to see the Constitution interpreted as it was before the New Deal, before the 1930s?
No, I think the notion that we would roll back the New Deal is absurd. You know, one of the attacks on Janice Rogers Brown, who was a highly popular justice, highly popular because she gets reelected by a very high margin, highest margins in the state, on the California Supreme Court. She's a highly respected judge. She writes more opinions virtually than anybody else because she's assigned more opinions because she's such a well-respected member of that court. And remember that California is one of the most liberal states in the union. She's anybody who gets elected by the widest margin to the Supreme Court of one of the most liberal states in the union cannot, by definition, be considered a right-wing nut. But she's attacked because she once described 1937, the year where the Supreme Court affirmed a lot of the New Deal, as, quote, our socialist revolution. Now, she's been misquoted so that she's apparently quoted as having said, this was a socialist revolution. No, she said it was our socialist revolution. To me, that's perfectly fair game to say that we had a very mild form of revolution that had swept most of the rest of the world, particularly Europe, with a vengeance. And to say that the New Deal was a mild sort of form of socialist revolution seems to me perfectly in the mainstream. And I don't think anybody would argue with that. I don't see how you could argue, but no one is arguing that we should roll the clock back and go back to 1900.
The ABA, the American Bar Association, used to vet Supreme Court and judicial nominees, both for the Judiciary Committee and for the president himself. Orrin Hatch changed that to the Federalist Society when he was head of the Judiciary Committee, and President Bush also changed that. He doesn't use the ABA, he uses the Federalist Society to vet his nominees. Do you agree that the Federalist Society should be doing it instead of the ABA? Do you think the Federalist Society is more neutral than the ABA?
I don't think the Federalist Society does any vetting. I don't know what you're talking about. The ABA still vets nominees as it has for the last half century. There is a change that President Bush made, which is that the ABA doesn't get the file to start the examination until after the nomination has occurred. In the past, it had happened when internally the White House said, gee whiz, we are thinking about X. In the old days, the ABA would be brought in weeks earlier. Now they're not brought in until there's a formal identification by the White House. But the ABA still has a full opportunity and takes it to evaluate and rate as qualified or not qualified or well qualified the nominees. And these ratings and evaluations are made available to the Senate before the hearings are held. So the ABA continues to play the role that it has played for half a century. The Federalist Society does nothing like this. So I don't know what is the origin of your question.
No, the question was about vetting somebody before they're officially, with the president, the question was vetting a nominee before they're officially nominated, before they're publicly nominated. My understanding was that...
Well, your understanding is wrong, I think.
Uh-huh.
The Federal Society does not vet anybody.
And not for the Judiciary Committee either?
No, I don't think so, not that I know of. It so happens, the misconception has arisen that this happens because so many nominees for the last 25 years happen to be members of the Federalist Society. But that's That's hardly remarkable. And the Federalist Society does not have a mechanism for vetting. They do not vet. And I don't think anyone relies on them for vetting. That's a, you know, sort of a specialized process, and it takes a lot of manpower to do that. And the principal vetting, of course, is done by the FBI, because what you're really worried about, you can always go on the internet and find someone's writings. What you're really worried about is something that is not on the surface, and that is something which is done by the FBI. It's done by the White House Counsel's Office. They ask very, very strict questions.
Are we having a semantic thing here? Is it because I use the word vetting as opposed to consultation, like pre-nomination consultation?
Well, I don't know what vetting has a very definite meaning.
Maybe I shouldn't use the word vetting. Maybe I should use the word pre-screening and consultation. Would that change the picture?
Well, is there consultation? People talk. Is there formal? Is there a formal mechanism? They have weekly meetings. Is there no? There's no formal consultation mechanism. Is there discussion among lawyers who are like-minded and think alike and see their colleagues on a periodic basis? Of course, there's discussion, but is there a formal consultation process? No. What happens is that many of the nominees turn out to be. In recent Republican administrations, say many of them turn out to be members of the Federalist Society. And so from that, people deduce, God, they must be in control. But there's nothing to control. There's no... The Federalist Society has a budget of about $4 million. I mean, it's a teeny organization. It doesn't have a sort of teams of researchers at the ready lined up in libraries to charge out to investigate... nominees. This is just not, I mean, it's a fantasy.
My guest is Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice, which supports and promotes President Bush's judicial nominees. Yesterday, we talked about judicial nominees with Ralph Neese, president of the liberal group People for the American Way. Boyden Gray will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice, which supports and promotes President Bush's judicial nominees. Let me ask you a little bit about the past. In a book about Clarence Thomas by Ken Foskett, he describes you as the most critical contact in Thomas's path to the judiciary. What was your role in bringing him to the attention of President Bush? Because you've been active in the judicial process for a long time, and I'm sure you've learned a lot of lessons over the years from your successes. And I'd just be interested in hearing, you know, some of the lessons you learned from the Clarence Thomas confirmation process. So let's start with why did he come to your attention? How did he come to your attention, and why were you so enthusiastic about him and wanting to bring him to the attention of President Bush?
Well, in fact, President Bush knew Thomas before I did, met him before I ever did, but. I got to know him because he was a commissioner at the EEOC, which involved some of my sort of activities in the White House, regulatory review that I was in charge of. So the EEOC was one of many agencies that I monitored. The chairman of the EEOC was one of the grandfathers of the disability movement, a man named Evan Kemp. Really, in many ways, the inspiration behind the Americans with Disabilities Act, which President Bush promised to enact in his campaign in '88, and then subsequently did get enacted, the first civil rights statute for disabled people in the world, and became a model for disability civil rights. Evan Kemp was a great friend of Clarence Thomas. They became very, very great friends, and I was a great friend of Evan Thomas, both because of our work on disability issues, but also because he was a a great person, and I have to confess, loved to play bridge, which I shared. And so I would see Thomas at his apartment from time to time, and in that capacity got to know Thomas better than I might have otherwise. So I knew of Thomas's grand and great qualities. Although I have no doubt that I played a key role in all of this, I just want to emphasize that President Bush knew Clarence Thomas before I did.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things you feel you learned from the Clarence Thomas confirmation process that you've applied to subsequent confirmations, even for federal courts?
Well, the one thing that sort of is a principle, you know, you wonder what the judges that are being blocked, that were being blocked, have in common. You know, that most of them tended to be women and minorities. I mean, a couple of women, you know, black, Hispanic, an Arab, the first Arab nominee, Saeed. The nominees that were blocked were predominantly minorities. And so one thing I've learned is that one thing the Democrats really don't like are minorities who are also conservative. What else have I learned? Well, that the nomination process has got a lot of problems, that the federal judiciary is too powerful, that it's become such a focal point for power that that's why these nominations become so hotly contested, why they become so fought over. And the problem is not anything with the wrong with the nominees. The problem is that there's just too much power. Now, I would argue and assert that what the Republicans want to do is to reduce that power by saying that judges should defer to legislatures, and defer to the original meaning of the Constitution, so as to reduce the power, relative power, of the courts vis-a-vis the legislature. That is oversimplified, I think, the basic philosophy of Republicans, but it's going to be a long time before we ever get there, if we ever do, and the courts are going to remain all-powerful arbiters of American life, and that's just a fact. I was in this panel discussion yesterday, and I reminded people, which I think people need to be reminded, that de Tocqueville said over 150 years ago, this great social critic and political critic of the United States from France said, this is a long time, early 19th century, that the genius of the American people was to take all intractable political questions and turn them into judicial ones for resolution by the courts. So the power of courts to issue essentially political judgments is not a new thing in our history. But the trouble is that the central governments are so much more powerful today than they were, say, 150 years ago, that you know, multiplies the power of the courts tenfold, and it makes people uncomfortable because, as I said earlier, the judges aren't elected and aren't responsive and aren't accountable to the electorate.
You know, you had said that you think that Democrats are uncomfortable with minorities who are conservative, and that would account, for instance, to some of the reaction against Clarence Thomas. I think what some Democrats might say is that Republicans sometimes intentionally choose people of color because it would be harder to contradict or attack their judicial views without it also seeming like you were being racist. Do you know what I mean? That makes it more difficult for anybody to oppose them. What would you say to that?
Well, Miguel Estrada is very much of this cut from the same cloth as a Bill Pryor, as a Patricia Owen, as a Mike McConnell, who was confirmed, as a Mike Luttig, who is now a candidate for the Supreme Court, possible. He's cut from the same cloth. And why should he not be nominated? Because he happens to be Hispanic and therefore lend himself to the kind of accusation that we're playing the race card. Well, what that means is we cannot nominate minorities who happen to be conservative. And that's absurd. But we'd be accused of being anti-minority. The logic of this is, in other words, is comical.
Another question that has been raised is, since President Bush has said that he wants to be a uniter, not a divider. Since he won by a 3% majority, which isn't that large, and since the Republicans control the House and the Senate now, should there be a greater responsibility on the president to appoint moderate judges to the federal courts and to the Supreme Court?
The only way I can answer that question is where I started. What he has done is in the mainstream of what Republican presidents have done for 25 years. If anything, his judges are less conservative than his father's or Reagan's. Why on earth, after having for the first time not only won re-election but increased his margins in the House and Senate for the first time probably ever, should he say, gee whiz, I should go veer off to the left and get out of the mainstream of the Republican Party for the last 25 years? That is totally preposterous. It's a preposterous suggestion. He's not going off to the right as a result of that. He is doing what Republican presidents have been doing for 25 years. He ought to be allowed for the remainder of his term to continue in the same tradition.
And when you're talking about that tradition, you're talking about Chief Justices, Clarence Thomas.
I'm talking about his nominees to the bench.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, and you know, gosh, judges don't always behave the way you want them to after they've been on the court for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
The landscape is littered with people who disappointed their sponsors. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes is the prime example. You know, I think most of the judges on the Supreme Court now are Republican, but some of them are the most liberal. Some of those Republicans are the most liberal, like Souter and Stevens. So, you know, liberals shouldn't be so panicked about all this. This is not the end of the world, and the president ought to be entitled to do what he's been doing and what Republicans have been doing for the last 25 years. And to say that he should now pull back and start giving things to his enemies when he's not doing anything that is different than any Republican president has done strikes me as being silly.
Boyden Gray, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Boyden Gray is the founder of the Committee for Justice, which supports and promotes President Bush's judicial nominees. Yesterday, we talked about judicial nominees with Ralph Neese, president of the liberal group People for the American Way. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new solo album by Graham Coxon, former lead guitarist of the British band Blur. This is Fresh Air. Graham Coxon was, until 2 years ago, the lead guitarist for Blur, a British band known for their loud, elaborate psychedelia and extravagant emotionalism. Blur was a huge hit act in Britain and a moderate success in the States. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Coxon's new solo album, Happiness in Magazines, is much simpler, much less blurry, and much better.
There'll always be an England, a land where just a few years ago the debate raged in rock circles, who was the bigger, better band, Blur or Oasis? Here in America, a comparatively small number of people said, gee, these are two amusingly grumpy, loud bands, and let it go at that. As a solo artist, Graham Coxon is liberated from Blur to come into focus as a fellow with low-key charm and oodles of self-deprecation. Didn't the start of that song sound like it was going to swerve into the Moody Blues' Nights in White Satin? Graham Coxon seems to be using this album to nod in the direction of fellow Britons he has a fondness for. He's spoken in interviews of how freshly impressed he was when he listened to Paul McCartney and Wings' old album Band on the Run recently. You can hear that influence in a carefully crafted but loose, baggy song like Hopeless Friend.
Listen, my hopeless friend.
As a singer-songwriter, Graham Coxon is a guitarist, which is to say, his voice is nothing special, just a soft, chalky sound. And when he can think up the right excuse, he likes to rip loose with some searing guitar tracks that he layers on top of each other and then speeds up, like this.
Nothing to see, nothing to hear, nothing to be, nothing to fear, nothing to prove, nothing to say, nothing to lose, nothing to gain, nothing to feel, nothing to hate, nothing is real, it's all too late. What do you do when nothing's wrong? I got a clue, I got no song. Yeah,
this album, Happiness in Magazines, contains the sort of music that, unfortunately, America seems to have little use for at the moment. I'm not talking about the jangly guitar rock that appeals to little more than aging nostalgists, but the sort of album that can be listened to as an album, a collection of songs that cohere as an artistic statement. In Coxon's case, his album tells the story of a guy who's relieved at not being the next big thing, and who's given up rock star substance abuse, as well as the emotional abuse that rock stars can inflict upon the people around them. Coxon is that oddity, a humble guy who hasn't lost his touch, who can dial it down without losing the juice that makes his music electrical.
Ken Tucker is author of the new book, Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. He reviewed Happiness in Magazines by Graham Coxon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Now the end is in sight. I'm just tired. Lying awake at night. So wired. And fired. Up with biological urge in my belly. And a head full of words and my tail.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And from Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of Hallowed Bones, a mystery set in the Mississippi Delta by Carolyn Haynes, author of Crossed Bones. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the debate over the president's Social Security plan. We talk with Michael Tanner, director of the Cato Institute's Project on Social Security. He supports the president's plan. And we hear from economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. He opposes the plan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.